So, Leanne, you've just in this last week finished or almost finished writing your history of the RMA for the 150th anniversary. Before we talk about what you've discovered in researching this history, I wonder, this must feel like more of a personal project than a professional sort of scholarly assignment for you. There's a personal aspect to it. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your own history with the RMA. What has the association meant to you?
Well, it's been a real lifeline in many ways because when I first came to Britain, I was a postgraduate student still writing my PhD. That's why I came, was to do research at the British Library. And I saw it as a place to make a connection right away. And my supervisor at the time happened to be in Britain as well. And he recommended me for full membership. So I went along. My first meeting was a Saturday morning. I was the only female in the room, apart from Elsie Arnold, I think, and I was the only person under about 55, I think.
Do you remember what date that was?
That was in the autumn of 1980. And I knew there were younger people. What I didn't know was that they'd go to their own research students' conference. They didn't necessarily go to every monthly meeting at that time. At the coffee break, I just thought, where are the younger people? Have I made a big mistake? And eventually, of course, I didn't make a big mistake. I just kept going because in the States, you do go. It's part of your training as a professional to join in, find out what other people think, listen, learn, all those things. And eventually, I felt much more at home. And through the years, I made lots and lots of good friends. And of course, research ideas flow. So it's worthwhile going. Eventually, I think I gave my first paper in 1987 on a day meeting, and then I gave another paper at a conference, an annual conference in 1989. Then I joined the council through a vote and found out a lot more than I knew as a member. And then I stepped back to do my child-rearing duties and private research.
It's a very similar, actually, story for me in the sense that it's been a long-term international engagement with, and I'm speaking to you from Perth, but because of my research relying so much on British libraries and archives, every year I went over there, joined the RMA, and I think met you at a Music in 19th Century Britain conference, perhaps in Belfast, or maybe it was before then at an RMA conference, actually. And yeah, similar idea that you went for. Connection to the sort of the British musicological context, but then also found that it was a very outward-looking organisation that was that had a sort of international mandate almost. It's much more than a professional organisation. It's it's a community. It's a real scholarly and personal community. How did it feel writing the history? And I mean, obviously, you started at the foundation of the organization, but coming into your own period of time and you see the names of people who, you would have met during those early years of your own engagement, and all of a sudden it becomes your own story interweaving into the organization's story.
That is very well observed. I felt very much like a historian when I was first starting. And then when it comes up to the period of time where you know all these people, it's revealing to you personally, but it also means you're a part of the story. And I think I have to take effort to be careful with what I say about people. But also, I was never disappointed in anything I learned. Or in fact, I just had my eyes opened about how complicated some of the processes are and how well things worked out because of the independence of the organization. It's not based in any one university. It's not run by an academic mandate. There's no money that comes from anywhere else except members' annual subscriptions, really, and the sale of what we produce. So we do get income from what we create, which is our work. But also, you understand there's a long time lap between when people in the RMA realize this is a bit old-fashioned, should we change? And when they actually start changing. They think about it, talk about it, but they don't want to do anything too quickly because it might compromise procedures that have been set in place for decades. So things do look old-fashioned for a while. Also, you notice as you go through records how many times somebody has a bright idea, says, let's do this. I think it would improve things. John Stainer said, why don't we have a small committee who looks at proposals and let them choose which papers we program? And they said, oh, no. They talked about having what we now call a proceedings committee or something like that, a sessions committee, for decades before they instituted one. Because the fear was, oh, if we delegate that to a small group of people, then the rest of us won't have a say. And it's very democratic. Everything was so democratic all the way across, which is, again, admirable. Because it was a small organization, they could do it that
I
way.
could do it that way. Yeah, going keeping with the sort of democratic theme, and also going back to what you're saying about the independence of the organization from any one institution or one funding source. Can you tell us a little bit about the establishment or the years just before the establishment of the RMA? I mean, you write in the history that the RMA was neither inevitable nor bound to last. And I'm wondering what you mean by that. Can you sketch us a picture of the situation just before the RMA was established?
Yes. Well, obviously, these are the Victorian years when we tend to think everybody wanted to know everything and set up an organization, thrusting knowledge and, new scientific information. And there are a lot of stereotypes about that. But the problem here with music was that it is so multilateral that you get people wanting to divide and claim what music is against what someone else wants to claim music is. It's a perennial problem. We still have that. There were at least three attempts at setting up a scholarly society for music before 1874. The problem was that they were always attached for financial reasons to a concert-giving body of one kind or another, assuming that giving concerts and getting people to come to concerts was the money that would set up the scholarly aspect. And it was found every single time. Given the choice, ordinary folks would not go to a scholarly paper. So the final coup that brought the whole thing together and made it last was the bringing in of a couple of scientists who thought, well, think about how the Royal Society, the real Royal Society, was set up in 1660. It was not based on, everybody practicing the same kind of science, or everybody necessarily being eminent in everything. It was for people who wanted to investigate. So when the emphasis comes on to investigation of any kind of sound, not just printed music or sung music or performed music, then you suddenly have a panoply of people who become actually expert at how to run a learned society. That was the missing element. How do these things work? Organizationally. And the first thing you have to do is make it stick by protocols and paper giving that can be yielding published papers. And at that very first organizational meeting, there were 22 people invited. Six of them were members of the Royal Society. They were the leaders of this whole initiative. And without wishing to demote performed music, they made it clear, we are not putting on concerts. We want people who are interested in investigating and discussing. The alternative side of investigating is that you tell people what you found and you tell it formally and you publish it, but you could also send in a three-line letter. It becomes a kind of what have you found out? And therefore, you have to come to hear other people's findings. It is true that in the first few years, there was a heavy dose of science, mostly physics, mostly instruments and their vibrations, that kind of thing. But a perfectly valid study that had many applications within ethnomusicology, right from the very earliest days of the formation of that doctrine. All this was completely separate, I should say, from Musikwissenschaft and its origins in Austria, Germany. But that's also something I take up in the book.
As you say, the idea that these scientists had the sort of institutional, organizational, the institutional knowledge to know what an a learned society could look like, but there must have also been a range of voices tempering the idea that it would turn into a fully professionalized organization quickly. I suppose thinking about the sort of three words in the title of the organization, the fact that it's musical and not musicological, the fact that it's an association and not a society or an academy, and even the term royal doesn't indicate a royal charter, does it?
Not at all, no. In the beginning, it was just Musical Association. That was chosen after a long meeting in which the name was thrashed out. Musical Science Society was once considered. Musical Scientific Society was once considered. And the Musical Society was another one considered. Association was chosen, I believe, to indicate not just that this is not about elite or select people that can be in it, but that we are crossing disciplines, we are crossing social class, we are crossing musical knowledge with other kinds of knowledge. There really was no professional place for any of this kind of work, except by people who were doing something else and they were paid. Some were attached to universities. John Stainer is the key example as a professional organist and a theorist and a composer, but he had not got a lot of experience in research. Nobody was trained in how to do musical research. There was no such thing as musicology, and they certainly avoided that word, even when it was used as a translation of the French musicologie. They never used musicology. In fact, they were still embarrassed to talk about musicology in the 1960s. There are letters from Frank Howes saying we need to be careful with that word because it was off-putting to people who love music and thought musicology was out to destroy music.
When people talk about amateurism, it's often used, obviously, in the pejorative now, or as a kind of rebellion against institutional elitism, or a reactionary force against a progressive force, or the opposite. This is a very politicized term, but at the time, the situation that you're describing with polymath thinkers coming in from a scientific lens, saying, "Look, I'm really curious about this art form." With a whole different system of meaning creation and emotional response and, whatever parameters that they were looking at, that the term amateur had connotations of somebody who was approaching something without, for its own sake, not for any sort of professional money-making purpose, not they weren't professional musicians, as you say, but the idea of approaching music as an object and sound as an object of curiosity, that sort of I'm not going to say objectivity because that's also a term with a lot of baggage, but there was, do you think, a valorization of a certain type of amateurism that was designed to provoke intellectual discussion at a very, not anti-authoritarian, but anti-institutional, just a sort of collegial, scholarly, but rigorous level? Does that
Yes,
play into it?
it does. If you think of the traditional meaning of amateur as being a social class distinction, where someone is born into privilege and wealth,
It
they
doesn't
have the
need to
money
be a
to
professional.
purchase. They have the money to purchase the sources. And the chief wonderful amateur at the beginning was Stainer's own teacher, and he had this amazing library collection. Sir Frederick Ouseley. Ouseley was an aristocrat. He was proudly an amateur, but he also was working at Oxford. So he would never have wanted to be considered a professional. But he was the font of all the knowledge and gave more than one paper. He was the first elected president by acclamation because he seemed to have the status in every possible form of meaning of that word. And the strange thing is, he didn't come to many meetings. He didn't show up very much at council meetings. He was a figurehead. Stainer, by contrast, was a professional musician. And I would not call him an amateur scholar, but he wasn't a musicologist either. He was still learning. And he, by fortunate discovery and training of colleagues he knew at Oxford in the library, particularly, he discovered one of the most amazing manuscripts that we have still studied, the Canonici, one in Oxford that has all these amazing 15th century songs that totally changed the face of our knowledge of early Renaissance music. And he really did a good job considering that particular time of understanding, transcribing, trying to play some of those pieces with modern string instruments in his first paper. And he was still very young. He was a nominal founder. I don't think he was the chief reason the whole thing was set up, but I have changed a little bit my view on the founders as a group of people since doing this research. He's obviously central and very, very important, but he was not the single founder.
You were mentioning about the types of activities that he and others were doing that sort of fed into their formal papers that people gave at the events of the early organization in its sort of nascent period. And the types of activities that sort of feed into the organization seem to be around editing, especially editing of early music, discovery of of manuscripts, transcription and early ethnographic work, and also cataloging. Which I guess is, from this kind of scientific character or tendency in the early organization. From that, we get the importance of the RMA's relationship with the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, and also its relationship with the early collecting practices of the British Museum and the music collection that ended up at the British Library.
You've asked about Grove as it developed. The first dictionary grew and grew and grew. People got interested in research, not having known that they would. He was asking people to write and paying them for writing on subjects they weren't necessarily expert at. And that's what made them expert, was that he said, do the research and write me something. So it was an very much a everybody is at the beginning. Nobody knows what they're doing. They're all experimenting. And this notion of experimenting was very useful because it means you're not fitting a pattern, you're not ticking boxes, you're trying things to see what works. It's very much empirical. Sound research was empirical too, and some of it was related to foghorns in mist, and foghorns in rain, and foghorns in sunshine. That was John Tyndall, the Irish experimental physicist, who now is hugely important because of his discoveries about climate science and why the sky is blue. He was a founding member and a first vice president. He was one of the few who wrote in and said, thank you so much for honoring me with a vice presidency to be a member of your group. There were others of his ilk. They were not necessarily siding with the literary folks. There were little camps of people in, who had their interests. The literary side has remained strong because of needing to communicate what music is and what it can be and what we all think about what we've learned by doing research. Communicating that knowledge is part of the mission of the society. You give your paper and then you discuss it. Discussing the findings and then somebody coming along and changing them, that's the scientific method. And then you discuss it again 10 years later or 100 years later. You discuss it again. That's part of getting better at what we do. Publishing it in a dictionary is a different project. And those subsequent editions of Grove changed. Not all of them were as good as the first one. The specialist dictionaries come along in the 80s after the New Grove. And the New Grove is a huge shift, actually, in the reputation of British musicology. It sort of trumpeted to the whole world. These people know what they're talking about. And it took that long, until the 1980s before British musicology was really quite as well respected as it should have been. And they all agreed by that point to use the word musicology.
So we have these themes of the RMA and the group of people around it at the beginning and in the early decades. This image of, a really diverse membership, a diverse membership that was, interested in public-facing work, which seems to be, where the organisation is trying to rediscover those type of imperatives now in its current membership and its equity, diversity, inclusion initiatives and all sorts of other types of interdisciplinary reaching out and international reaching out. I wonder if you could finish perhaps by saying whether writing this history has changed your view of the organisation.
I would say I was surprised by how interesting it all was. I thought it would be boring. I thought it would be tedious. I thought I would have a hard time finding anything very remarkable to say about these people. They all seem like old men, dusty. The record is okay. You can peel away a layer of dust and find something trivial. But I continued to find real turns of thought and belief that I had not understood before from the way things have been written about in a secondary way. We pass on so many stereotypes without realizing what we're saying. When you go back and peel it away, it's a bit like a historical performance. When you realize, hey, we might have been got the wrong end of the stick here, I continually found that feeling. And I thought, there's so much more here that I did not understand. And why have we waited so long to recognize the brilliance of some of these people? And you say, what have I really learned? I think I found myself. And the reason for my curiosity about what I've been studying for 45 years was vindicated. Yet this was worth being interested in. But also, you are standing on the shoulders of some great people. And I'm so lucky I knew some of them, really, really well. I remember hearing fleeting comments about the RMA or the council. But what these people did out from spokes of their own work, not necessarily representing the RMA, but I knew they were. And their work was not necessarily academic, though many of them were right in the center of the top of music academia. They all got along and they all benefited from the knowledge that the other one brought in. And there's always this kind of arena of discussion. What we must keep open is that people join in, that people come, that people listen, that they participate, they comment when they don't like something. Or if they have a great idea, all those things feed into the vitality of this group. And I would hate to see that go just because we all are too busy publishing our books and our papers for our universities. We have to think of this as a live thing that's bigger than any one person, bigger than the job you have. I know people don't have time to devote to an organization that seems trivial sometimes, but it's very important. And it's what makes the RMA different from every other scholarly music organization in the world. The important thing is that we support it and keep it going to be independent and eclectic and welcoming to everybody.
Yeah, jump in, participate, contribute, listen, debate, attend. They're fantastic,
Absolutely.
fantastic messages. Leanne, thank you so much for writing this history and also for chatting with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.